So tonight, my talk is based on this sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. The translation I have of the title is the conditioned wisdom. In other translations, you see the word translated as discernment, but it's what it's talking about is sort of the phases, the stages where wisdom arises as we go deeper into the practice. And that's sort of the focus of the sutta. I'll just read the introduction in the first part here. There are, O monks, these eight causes and conditions for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life, when it has not been obtained, and for bringing about the increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development of the wisdom that has already been attained. What eight? Here a monk lives in dependence on the teacher or on a certain fellow monk in a position of a teacher, and he has set up towards him a keen sense of shame and moral dread and regards him with affection and respect. This is the first cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So finding a teacher, this is a really interesting thing to look at. First of all, remember in the Buddha's time, you know, that was the only way to get to hear the Dhamma was to actually be directly in contact with someone who was teaching. I mean, there was no internet, books even. None of this was written down until a couple hundred years after the Buddha passed. So finding a teacher was quite essential. But even today, it's an important aspect. And I want to read sort of a fairly long section from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation, where he talks about the role of the teacher. Dharma practice takes us to the edge of what is known. Mostly in our life, we create for ourselves a domain of comfort where everything is in place and we know where we stand. All our mind builds strong defenses to maintain reassuring stability in our inner realm. But this security also has limits to us, to the familiar, to the easily recognized. There are worlds of experience and ways of being that lie beyond the habits of our conditioning. Do we have courage of heart and spirit to explore the unknown? A teacher, guide, or spiritual friend can be of inestimable help on the path. Such a person can reveal what is hidden, point out the path, and inspire our highest aspirations. As we pass the boundaries of familiarity, we experience suffering and happiness in new and unexpected ways. Sometimes suffering spurs our effort to be free. At other times, we simply become mired in patterns of suffering, unable to find our way out. Happiness can trap us even more. There are many nice resting places along the spiritual path. We begin to feel more peaceful, more in harmony, better adjusted, and more accepting. We relate better to others. Our life gets easier, and we may decide to settle into this place of ease for a nice long rest. A good teacher knows when a student is stuck, either in suffering or in a kind of happiness. Employing a variety of skillful means, the teacher uses everything as fuel for the fire of awakening. At times we need encouragement and loving support, at other times perhaps a fierce wake-up call. And then there's sort of the yellow flag part of this. One area of difficulty that can arise in the student-teacher relationship is confusion between power and authority. In all domains of life, we encounter people who have more understanding than we do about certain things. Acknowledging the difference opens us to learning from such people. It helps us keep a beginner's mind. But acknowledging someone's understanding in a particular area should not be confused with conferring power. We can welcome guidance, instruction, and inspiration without abandoning our own inner moral sense. Problems related to power may come from both sides. Teachers may have had some genuine level of realization, but may not be fully liberated. And so at times they may act from places of ignorance. Students may be too willing to surrender their own powers of discriminating wisdom in the name of spiritual humility. We often mistakenly assume that because someone has genuine understanding in one particular area, this mastery necessarily extends to all other areas of life. This may or may not be true. In the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, the teacher is considered a Kalyana Mita, a spiritual friend. A true Kalyana Mita acts out of kindness and compassion for the suffering of beings. When we recognize a natural authority in teachers because of their wisdom, their knowledge, their compassion, and when they act from that natural authority, not from some less skillful place of power, then we can benefit immeasurably from their guidance. It says a lot. And it's this delicate balance he's pointing to that I wanted to make sure you understood, that it's okay to have a teacher, but I love the Theravada view that this is just a spiritual friend. There's no such thing as a guru in the Theravada tradition. It just doesn't exist. The idea of it doesn't exist. It's just the someone who's teaching is this someone who seems to know more than you, or knows more than you, practice more, has studied more, whatever, and then shares what they know. That's all I try to do. I'm certainly not in any sense enlightened or looking for power. The other thing is, in our world, I mean, in the Buddhist time, like I said, there's no books and no podcasts, only direct relationship with the teacher. That was the only way to study the Dhamma. The danger of our current world is that we take in many things from too many different directions. It's like, you know, we read a book about this form and another book about that form and this idea and this idea and this teacher. It's so tempting because they all sound so great, right? And then what we end up basically in the land of confusion, because the forms of practice, and even in just the Buddhist world, are quite distinct in some cases. They approach things from different ways. They have different angles, different ideas, different traditions, and trying to sort of somehow synthesize it all together by yourself is always going to cause you confusion. There's a really famous Indian proverb I like that describes this quite well. It says, if you want water, you don't dig 10 one-foot holes. You dig one 10-foot hole. And that's what we have to do. We have to sort of find a tradition, a form, a teacher, or a set of teachers, a community, like the Insight Meditation in New Colorado, a community of teachers who are coming at things from essentially the same place, and then sort of drink deeply from that. I once heard Joseph Goldstein say something really wise, I thought. Someone was asking him about, you know, studying in other traditions. And he said, well, first off, you have to find a particular tradition, a particular form that suits you, that feels right. And it's good to explore initially and find something that feels right. But once you've found that thing that feels right, then that should be your practice for the next 10 years. And then after you've practiced seriously for 10 years, you're ready to take in teachings from other traditions because you're so grounded in your own tradition. And then it can be sometimes quite beneficial to hear things from other traditions. So that's the idea of taking a teacher and a teaching. And the sutta goes on. As he is living in dependence on such teachers, he approaches them from time to time and inquires, how is this, venerable sir? What is the meaning of this? Those venerable ones then disclose to him what has not been disclosed, clear up what is obscure, and dispel his perplexity about many perplexing points. This is the second cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So not only do you need to find a tradition, a teacher, a teaching, but then it's very wise to question it. Question everything. Don't just, well, this is what it says, so it must be true. It's like it's really good to think about it and then approach these people you're studying with, practicing with, and ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. In fact, it's very good to ask questions because sometimes just asking the question, it's like something that's sort of floating around in the back of your mind, and just sort of formulating the question gives you clarity. And sometimes just getting ready to ask the question gives you the answer, by the way, too. Sometimes just that process you have to go through to ask an intelligent question sometimes gives you the answer. But otherwise, make sure you ask questions of your teacher or the teachers you're working with. It's like you need to, you know, hear the teaching. You have to understand the teaching, but you also have to be able to go, yes, but, you know, and poke a little bit. Reach out and ask questions. If a teacher doesn't take questions, don't just walk away. That's the other part of my advice with this. If the teacher won't ask, try to answer your questions. Just says, no, just listen to what I have to say and do what I say. That's a very good time to just wave goodbye and walk away. Then we come. This is here's the third one. Having learnt the Dhamma, he dwells withdrawn by way of two kinds of withdrawal of body and withdrawal of mind. This is the third cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So he's talking here about the tradition of seclusion. And certainly once again in the Buddhist time, this meant, you know, going off away from everybody else. You know, if you become a renunciate, you'd go someplace where you weren't going to be disturbed by all those other people all around, and then you didn't sort of sit down in the middle of a city street. You went off to a quiet place. And as I want to read a couple of things from the suttas here. This is one of these many suttas where the Buddha is talking about what you should do to once you've sort of reached a certain stage, you've studied, you have a teacher, you've studied, you've sort of got into the process. Now what do you do? What more is done? Here, because the bhikkhu resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap straw. Well, this probably isn't what we're going to do. We're householders, for one thing. So we're probably not going to withdraw. Though that's what retreat's about, because, you know, if you think about retreat places, they tend to be quite, you know, away from everything and quiet. So it's like seclusion in a way. And it's quite skillful to find that, you know, for retreat life. But, you know, we can't do, here's the Buddha again. This is the Buddha describing his process to Sariputta. He says, such is my seclusion, Sariputta, that I would plunge into some forest and dwell there. And when I saw a cowherd or a shepherd or someone gathering grass or sticks or a woodman, I would flee from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket, from hollow to hollow, from hillock to hillock. Why was that? So that they should not see me or I see them. Just as a forest-bred deer, on seeing human beings, flees from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket. When I saw a cowherd or a shepherd, such was my seclusion. So he's saying, you have to, it's effort. What he's implying here, of course, is that to be secluded in the way he's talking takes effort. It's Now we're householders, so we're not going to go live in seclusion in the forest. We have to live in the world. But I think what he's for us, what this means is we have to seriously think about how we live our lives. And if we go out into the world because we have a job, well, we got to go out to the world because we have a job and we have to work, and I understand that. But then you don't need to continue hanging out with all those people afterwards, which was like a very common thing. I remember having a job like that. After work, oh, let's all go and have a beer and blah blah blah, and off would all go, and it just would continue on, and it would be like, instead of going, oh, well, no, I need to go home and be quiet. What we do on the weekends, what we do with our vacations, all those sorts of things. We don't need to go to some loud, busy place. We can consciously choose where we hang out and what we do with our lives. And it's an important choice we have to make. And that's, I think, how we answer that. I was that first thing I read about, going to a heap of straw or the forest, that's a repeated theme. You see that exactly the same wording in several places in the sutta. But there was a couple of places they had also had, I thought this was great. They said, when someone comes and asks questions, when you're in this mode of seclusion, you should answer in a way that discourages long discussion. Like, don't encourage people to sort of get into long rap with you. In the times when you're in seclusion, do everything you can to keep the seclusion solid. And whether this is like, I have friends who one day a week, off the phone, unplug the computer, they just stay in seclusion that day. They fast, some of them too. It's like they consciously choose to separate themselves in that way. I'm not saying we need to do that. I don't do that, to be honest with you. But it's like, oh, this is an interesting way to things. Just like, let's step back a little bit. Then the Buddha goes on. He's virtuous, restrained by the restraint of the teachings, perfect in conduct and resort, seeing danger in the slightest faults. Having undertaken the teaching rules, he trains himself in them. This is the fourth cause and condition for obtaining wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So just leading a virtuous life. I'm not going to talk about this. I've talked about this a lot lately. It's just, this is so built into the Buddha's teachings. Every time you see a list like this, oh, here's the steps you can get that go through. There's always a step that talks about virtue. It's always like, because leading a virtuous life allows mind to go calm and still. It's really that simple. Yeah. Then he goes on. He has learned much, remembers what he's learned, and consolidates what he has learned. So not only learn it, you sort of consolidate it. Sort of implies, I've thought of it a lot. I can sort of see how this all fits together, how this teaching and that teaching sort of interrelate, and sort of gone a little deeper into your understanding of it, right? Such teachings as are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and which affirm a holy life that is perfectly complete and pure, such teachings as these he has learnt much of, memorized, recited verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. This is the fifth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. First of all, once again, this is in the Buddha's time. This is how the teachings were passed on. The Sangha, each member of the Sangha had a duty to memorize certain of the teachings, and then later on, when as a more senior person, he'd teach someone more junior the teaching, and they would memorize it. And that because this was a totally an oral tradition, but It was more than just a way to pass on the teachings. When you memorize a teaching, it's like it sinks in some way that is different, just reading it and sort of remembering it. Because to actually memorize it, that's why I like chanting the Metta Sutta, for instance, or chanting the sharings of blessings on my retreats. I always like to chant the sharings of blessings at the end of the day. Those sorts of things, it's like it sinks in deeper somehow or other. It has like more of an organic experience of learning than just reading it and sort of knowing it. When you memorize something, it has a deeper connection somehow. I'm speaking from personal experience too, by the way. This is something on my very first month-long retreat, when I was first introduced to something called the Sharing of Blessings and Aspirations, which is a fairly long, 30 lines or so teaching that we used to chant at the end of every day of teaching, like right at the end of the last sit in the evening, which I loved because I love chanting. And so I went around for the first 10 days or so of this retreat, chanting this thing over and over to memorize it. And then the very last section of this sharing, so it's called the Sharings of Blessings and Aspirations. The first step is to share, like literally give away anything you've learned that day, share it with the world. Then you state your aspiration to continue practicing. And that's sort of the second section. And the third section was essentially a repetition of the, the three refuges. So here I am, so 10 days in, I'm being quite restless. I've had a difficult time because I'd never done a long retreat like this before. But I'm walking around, I'm chanting this, the refuge section. It goes, the Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. So I was just chanting this, go for a walk, and after breakfast, and I'm chanting this over and over and over, memorizing, which is how I tend to memorize things, like repetition. And then I go and sit for the first sit after breakfast. Of course, because this has been in my mind, right? There I am, sitting, practicing, trying to just notice what's rising. And what am I doing? I'm chanting this over and over and over again. And then somehow or other, it's like, oh, I really am in a place of refuge. Like, because I'd been struggling so much, like struggling to be there and want to be there and questioning why I was there and full of doubt. And somehow or other, the words transformed into something at the heart level, where I really felt like I was in refuge in a way that I'd never, ever felt before. I actually broke down crying, and I had to, at the next, after I sat there and sort of wept through most of that sitting period. And then going for the walking period, I went and made myself a cup of tea. I had actually heard my mother's voice in my head saying, "What you need is a cup of tea." So I went up and got myself a cup of tea and sort of calmed down a little bit. But it was just, it really, the idea of refuge was no longer just sort of intellectual idea. And it's because of the memorization process I went through that it took on its significance. So, okay, memorizing. This is step six. He is energetic. He lives energy set upon the abandoning of everything unwholesome and the acquiring of everything wholesome. He is steadfast and strong in his effort, not shirking his task in regard to wholesome qualities. This is the sixth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So this, I summarize this as energetic, steadfast, and strong. We can't forget, and this is something we often do, we can't forget for 1 minute that this practice takes a lot of energy. This is not easy. We're choosing to do something where we actually have to put out energy and work at it all the time. And that's the steadfast part. It can't be like, well, I'll be energetic today and then, well, maybe next week I'll have some more energetic time. It's like we have to somehow find time to stick with it. You know, this also has to do with continuity of practice. So that's the steadfast part as well, like really making sure we do practice every day. You know, really sticking with that commitment we make to ourselves to practice and to study and to, you know, go to sanghas and hear teachings. It's something it takes energy. It takes a lot of energy. Just, I mean, you're putting out energy just sitting there listening to me. You're having to understand what I'm saying. And this takes energy. This isn't easy. And I love the word steadfast in this. Steadfast is like, I'm gonna stick with this. Yes, sir. it's a sort of an old-fashioned word. I like the feeling of it. Like it's steadfast. You know, it's very firm. It isn't like wishy-washy or sometimes I don't have anything better to do. I'm gonna be very steadfast in my practice and energetic, steadfast, energetic. Then, number seven, he's talking about what it's like to be with other people in the Sangha. And this was how things worked in the monastic tradition. They would all go off during the day and practice on their own, but then they'd come together in the evening, chant and to hear a Dhamma talk and just hang a little bit, right? This is what when he's in the midst of the Sangha, he does not engage in rambling and pointless talk. Either she himself speaks on the Dhamma, or she requests others to do so, or she does not slight silence. This is the seventh cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So here he's saying, basically, we not to spend a lot of time just blathering. Well, what's in some teachings are called frivolous talk. You know, one of the four forms of harmful speech. You know, either speak of Dhamma, ask others to speak of the Dhamma, or just maintain noble silence. Now, once again, we're householders, we live in the world, so we're not quite so severe as this. We can't go to the pharmacy to pick something up and, why are we going to talk to the pharmacist? Oh, we're going to talk to the pharmacist about Dhamma, and it's probably not going very well. So we have to sort of, deal with these things appropriately in our householder existence. But it's more pointing to, once again, where we put our energy in terms of speech. And what in speech and in learning. Because once again, here in this culture that they were a part of, the only way they heard Dhamma was when someone spoke of it. We're fortunate we have books and casts and all those sorts of things. But then we're choosing what to do with that. We're not being frivolous. And not saying you shouldn't sort of just have a little bit of frivolous fun once in a while. That's important too. We need to sort of don't want to turn into grim. Oh, I should only be doing this. I got to sort of, it turns that becomes unpleasant. You need to sort of balance your life a little bit, because we live out in the world and we have to interact with the world in a variety of ways. Then this is the final one here. He says, he dwells contemplating rise and fall in the five aggregates subject to clinging thus. Such is form, such its arising, such its passing away, such is feeling, etc. Perceptions, volitional formations, such as consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. This is the eighth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So now he's saying, okay, now everything else in the senses is getting ready for this. I've become disciplined. I'm being careful with my speech. I'm being careful how I live. All the conditions are right for me to really take in this teaching. This is the teaching of the five aggregates of clinging. This was, in terms of the what I've seen reading suttas and things, this was the Buddha's favorite topic. He talked more about the five aggregates of clinging than anything else, at least in terms of what's being gathered into the suttas, into the actual various books of teaching that are traditional now. This was the main topic. This was the big story. In this Samyutta Nikaya, the connected distances, the biggest section by far is the section on the five aggregates of clinging. There's 159 different teachings, and they're different sometimes very slightly, but he uses all kinds of images and different ways of explaining and different, comes at it from different angles. It's quite dense. I actually made a project 1 week or so of actually reading all 159 of them. Which was really, and some of them would be, this is the same as that other one, except they, I made little notes about the sort of the different ways he approached it. It was really fascinating just to see how many different ways he could speak about this thing. And some of the ways he did sort of resonated more with me than others, and some of them were like, I suppose so. It was also interesting that I didn't feel like I had to get everything. I could sort of, and which is, I think, what the Buddha did, is he spoke about things in many different ways, and different ways of speaking connected to different people, different temperaments, different personalities, whatever. So, but I do want to spend a little bit of time, since this is the end, because then he says, for these eight reasons, his fellow monks esteem him as one who truly knows and truly sees. And these qualities lead to affection, esteem, concord, and unity. So this is how, because everybody's doing this in the Sangha coheres. So why is this the five aggregates of being such a big deal? Why is this the one that the Buddha keeps coming back to over and over? And basically, it's because this is how, more than any other way, we can start to grasp what it means when we say not self. This is how he was trying to get us to understand not self, how to approach it in a way that sort of we could connect with some way more than just intellectually. So the Pali word for aggregates is skanda or kanda, and in Sanskrit skanda, which literally translates as heaps, piles. So the five piles of stuff is one way you could translate the five aggregates of clinging, the five piles of stuff that we cling to. And remember, clinging is the big problem. Like, it's that we cling to things that create suffering. If we can stop clinging, then so I want to just very briefly here's I want to read this from the sutta here. This is the actual instruction on contemplating the five aggregates of clinging, which is one of the dhammas in the fourth layer of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta. He knows such is material form, such is arising, such is passing away, such is feeling, such is arising, such is passing away, such is cognition, such is arising, such is passing away, such are volitions, such their arising, such their passing away, such is consciousness, such is arising, such is passing away. Notice the phrasing here. Every one of these heaps arises, something in one of them arises, and then it passes away. So he's pointing very directly in this instruction to see how impermanent all of these things are, how they have no solidity at all. They just rise and then they pass away. And it's equally important to see their arising and see their passing away. So what are these five aggregates? That's what I wanted to talk a little bit about. And so the first of these is called material form. In other words, anything. So, this glass that's in that heap. So is this body. So is any ideas I have about this glass or this body. Everything that we think of as having form is in the first one. The whole first heap. So it's a big heap. It's just everything, because if we know that, this arises and one day it'll break and pass away. Same with this body, same with everything we can think of that arises and passes away on at the form of physicalness, all fits in that file. And we can see, because we understand impermanence, that that's the nature of all things. They all arise, they all pass. So how could there be a separate self in there? Because they're all arising and passing. That's the idea here, right? So the second of these heaps, all the rest of the heaps are mental. So the first heap is all material stuff and everything else is mental. And he separates out a couple of important mental formations, mental arisings, to emphasize something. So the second of these is Vedana, which I've talked about before, sometimes translated as feeling tone. This is the mental formation that always arises immediately after we have the experience at any of the sense doors of something arising. So something arises at any of the sense doors, Vedana always arises. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's what always happens. This is what the Buddha, it's a big discovery that the Buddha made when he understood this, when he could see this, and he could see that the Vedana, the mental formation arising, was separate from the object. So it's a separate thing. It's purely mental. It has only those three forms. The next one is in the piles is perception or cognition. And that's that process, that mental process where we go, not only did something arise at the sense door, but I went, oh, that was a bird. Oh, it was blue. Oh, that was a blue jay. That's perception in operation. It just follows after something arises at the sense door. Vedana arises, then perception arises. That's the next thing that happens, always. And the thing about perception is, of course, it's pretty unreliable. And it's dependent on causes and conditions, just like Vedana is. I'll see some things because I want to see them, not because they're actually there. Well, I'll see them because I don't want to see them, and I see something that sort of reminds me of it, and I get scared. It wasn't really there at all. It's just my perception saw that because that was I was predisposed to see things in that way. So perception, cognition are very unreliable. They change all the time. We see something, and then, you know, we go, oh, I saw, I know what that was. And then we look a little closer, and our idea changes completely. Now, in the sutta, this perception is often compared to a mirage, where we think we see something, but who knows? Once again, not solid, changes all the time, very unreliable. We think, part of the point in our minds is we think our perceptions are really good, that we are all really good at perceiving things and seeing things as they really are. Basically, we're not. We're, you know, if you ever talk to a policeman about people going through lineups and pointing someone out, yeah, that's the guy. Total nonsense often, because their personal bias about what someone who did such a thing would look like can't get away right away. So you'll hear police will take descriptions of somebody, you know, at the scene they'll interview five people, and they'll get five different descriptions of the same person who supposedly did this thing. It's because our perception is not reliable at all. And it arises and then it's gone. It's just another mental formation that arises and passes away. Then the next layer is like what's called mental formations. And this is like everything else that in the sense of emotions and thoughts and moods and all those sorts of flavors of things. So basically, this is everything except Vedana and perception in terms of mental formations. And often in the commentaries and the things you read, they make special mention of intention and volition, because there's something that's going on all the time. These are mental formations. Like for me to wave my finger like this, I had to have the intention to wave finger before I could actually wave it. Without the intention, the waving never would have occurred. So anything that we do on the physical level is always preceded by a mental formation of intention. Other than a few automatic reactive things, like, you know, someone taps your hand, you know, your doctor taps your knee with one of those little hammers and your leg springs up. Well, that was unintentional. Pretty much everything we do and say is intentional first, because without intention, nothing happens. And so they put in special attention to this in the commentaries, but it's really talking about anything that's a mental formation that arises. And once again, we see, if we start to really look, that all those thoughts, all those emotions, all those moods, all those intentions arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. And if we can start seeing that, as opposed to intellectually, yeah, that sort of makes sense, we start to see how there's no solidity in any of it. Our mind is not, in any sense of the word, solid. It's just this flow of stuff going through. One thing after another, arising, passing away. And then the last of these, and this is the one that's a little trickier, is consciousness. You know, that sense of knowing. And the problem is, just like, you know, for a physical sensation, I'll say I see, and I create an I, a self out of that's doing the seeing, as opposed to this seeing has arisen or hearing has arisen. With consciousness, I immediately think, I know. It's not, there's no I there. Just consciousness is just moments of mental arise that are there, and then they're gone. It's just, they seem continuous because it's going on literally all the time. Consciousness is always there at some level, but it's not like one big blob of consciousness. It's many, many separate, discrete, tiny little bits of consciousness occurring so rapidly that they seem to be all one big thing. That they seem to be solid because they're so continuous, but they're not. They're just separated little moments of consciousness. The Buddha emphasizes this when he talks about the teachings on the six sense doors, where he talks about how ear consciousness and tongue consciousness and eye consciousness are separate things. And each moment of consciousness is based on the summarizing at one of the sense doors. So you get an arising sense door, Vedana arises, perception arises, some mental formation arises around it, and then consciousness arises. But all those things arise, and then they're gone. And when we can start to experience that, see that, that's what gives us the sense that, this idea of there being a separate self is just an idea. That's why it comes last in this list of eight things, because this is where the real work is done at a deep level. Everything else was preparing us for this. And then somehow or other we have to tune into this on some intuitive way, experiential way. Everything else is just arising and passing away. That's all there is to it. I want a little something here. This is the Buddha in this section I told you about. It's got 159 different teachings. And this is a householder has come to him for an explanation of this idea. Now, how, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons and is unskilled and undisciplined, regards form as self or self as form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He lives obsessed by the notion, I am form, form is mine. And he lives obsessed by these notions that form of his changes and alters. With changes and alteration of form, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. It's by the idea of an I in form, and he says this repeats for the other four. It's the idea that causes the suffering, not the stuff itself. Stuff is just stuff. It's the idea that somehow there's a separate me there, that as this me changes, and in my case, getting older, it deteriorates, we get disappointed. I can't deal with this fact that it's supposed to be me. I'm supposed to be solid. That's where the suffering arises. Well, if we can get past this idea of the separate self, the suffering disappears. We can stop clinging to this sense of self, which is what the whole teaching is all about. I came across a really interesting poem that sort of illustrates this way of thinking to a certain extent. This is a poet that was actually a Nobel laureate called Wisława Szymborska. It's Polish. This is his translation. I think it's Polish or Czech. I'm pretty sure it's Polish. And it's just sort of, you have to sort of sort of open your mind and sort of step back and listen to this, because she's talking in a very interesting way about how we see things. It's called View with a Grain of Sand. We call it a grain of sand, but it calls itself neither grain nor sand. It does just fine without a name, whether general, particular, permanent, passing, incorrect, or apt. Our glance, our touch means nothing to it, doesn't feel itself seen and touched. And that it fell on the windowsill is only our experience, not its. For it is no different from falling on anything else, with no assurance that it has finished falling or that it is falling still. The window has a wonderful view of a lake, but the view doesn't view itself. It exists in this world, colorless, shapeless, soundless, orderless, painless. The lake's floor exists floorlessly, and its shore exists shorelessly. Its waters feel neither wet nor dry, and its waves to themselves are neither singular nor plural. They splash deaf to their own noise, ripples neither large nor small. And all this beneath sky, by nature skyless, in which the sun sets without setting at all, and hides without hiding behind an unminding cloud. The wind ruffles it, its only reason being that it blows. A second passes, a second, a third. But there are 3 seconds only for us. Time has passed like a courier with urgent news, but that's just our simile. The character is invented, his taste is make-believe, his news inhuman. Everything we take to be real and solid and the way things are is just our projection onto them. That's what she's getting at. You know, there's no, we separate things out to sort of define them and make them something, but that separation is only in our minds. Only in our mind. That's what the five aggregates of clinging teaching is trying to get at, that it's all just in our mind, in our view of things. You know, that's why it's called a view with a grain of sand. It's just a view, but that's a grain of sand. It's the convenient definition that we need to have to sort of function in the world, perhaps, but that's all it is.